power of our diplomacy.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's a really big deal.
The strength of our diplomacy.
Oh, that's a really good point.
Yeah.
Five, six, five, four, five, six, seven, five, four, five, six, 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 five,
once.
Of Diplomacy Cast.
Yeah.
Diplomacy Cast is a podcast about the board game Diplomacy. I'm Eric Mead. Somebody here is Nathan Barnes.
I'm going to take the blame for that one. I am Nathan Barnes this week.
Yep. The one observing guy. Mr. Double One.
Yeah.
Going, Mr. Yeah. Double One.
Hey, you know what I'm impressed with? I'm impressed that we're 2:11 and it's not quite November, so we're actually ahead of schedule.
I don't know what our schedule is anymore.
I'm going to put us ahead of it.
Yeah, all right, awesome. We're way ahead of this schedule.
Killing it!
Bringing you out this special episode of Diplomacy Cast.
It's all about reframing the situation.
That's right. In today's episode, we're going to kick it off with the Hot Off the Press segment that we owed you from last time. We have a bunch of your emails that we wanted to read, get to. They're awesome. Yeah.
Good job with that.
Thanks.
I'm on the edge of my seat, and I know our listeners are too.
I know. I just really grabbed everybody by the heart there.
Yeah.
We're gonna kind of go back to a little more strategy intensive stuff again. We have this idea. We'll see how it goes. We want to talk about how to build in 1901.
And I think yes, that is what we're going to talk about. And the not so secret sort of point of that is to really highlight things. What not to do in 01 to make sure that you can grow and prosper.
It comes from a conversation we had a while ago where we realized how many people make mistakes there that they don't realize are mistakes.
Yeah.
And it's somewhat, yep. So, and finally, we're going to interview one Jerry JT Fest.
And that's mostly because he, I think he was important to my, my hobby growth. He was,
yeah.
He was just a guy around, like, and he's a great friend of ours.
He's the wise old gnome of diplomacy.
Yeah.
He doesn't even really, frankly, play the game so much anymore.
I mean, he will.
He will.
Yeah. He doesn't play competitively as much anymore, but he's won a Grand Prix, which I mean, neither one of us have done that.
No.
You've come close, I've heard, a couple of times.
Jerry Fest. You'll enjoy him.
Yeah, he's hilarious.
He's fun to talk diplomacy with.
Yeah.
If you've got any questions, any feedback, anything, email us, press@diplomacycast.com. That's press@diplomacycast.com. What's new with you?
What's new?
What's new, yeah. This is the part of the show where we just sort of informally chat about some things that are on our mind about diplomacy.
Oh, wow. Well, let me just scrape the back of my head. You know, I was reading my favorite diplomacy scene the other day.
Oh, all right. Well, I'll just talk about my thing then.
Yeah.
That's fine.
I'm sorry. Was that a soft enough lob? Did that segue smoothly?
I wasn't trying to segue. I was really asking what was new with you in diplomacy. But I'll talk about my thing first. The new issue of Diplomacy World came out recently, and I wrote an article in it that, if you guys haven't seen it yet and you want to read about the greatest variant of diplomacy ever invented.
Written by probably just a madman. It's a fairly simple game that he manages to write an article about it, like it's 8 pages long.
Nine.
And just rife with, like, vaguely criminal, somewhat scary.
It may be the greatest thing that anyone's ever written, ever. Be sure to check out your new issue of Diplomacy World if you haven't already. But it is about a game that both Nathan and I invented.
That
and
is true.
I wanted to just mention it. It's called Diplomacy Winks. You throw the pieces on the board, and wherever they land, you kind of have to make a diplomacy game out of it.
Yeah, it's sort of like that if it was, I don't know, Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas style.
Yeah.
I mean, that's pretty much, when you read the article, that's what it sounds like.
Yeah, it is a little bit like that. It was a bit of a Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas tournament, as I recall, where we invented that.
I don't remember which one of us played Hunter S. Thompson.
But for those of you who have played Diplomacy Wakes before, if I've tried to teach it to you at a tournament or something, or one of us has, I didn't actually...
Wrong.
Yeah, I didn't actually know the rules to our own game until very recently, and so there is, in all of my mad rantings, there is written in the actual rules of the game, yeah. And this is something of a new development, and so Diplomacy Wakes fans out there, you can actually play it and not feel like you're making it up as you go along,
yeah.
Which...
No, there's actually rules now. Yeah,
so...
For certain, like, even certain complex situations, now resolvable.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, if you can decode my...
Yeah, I mean, like, through the Robitussin.
Yeah, right. Through your Robitussin haze and through your...
Exactly.
Through your, all right.
Well, yeah, moving exactly. On. Moving on. And, you know, speaking of teaching games to people, we did have a game here in Seattle about a month ago.
Yeah.
The Canterbury.
That was kind of fun. We're trying to do this again. We're actually doing the house game thing a little bit.
Yeah, you know, as it comes.
Or actually the bar game is would be more technically correct. But there's a bar in Seattle where we've been doing this for many years now.
Many years. I mean, the first time I met Mr. Mead here not the very first time, but one of the first times I met him was at the Canterbury.
Yeah.
Well, near... decade ago.
Yeah,
actually.
That's true. I invented the Canterbury game.
Yes,
that's,
you have that.
That's on me. Yeah.
Yes, it is. But it's a great little bar nearby, and you know a lot of other hobbies around the hobby groups around the country do this. In Chicago in particular, you know, there's a place they go to play Diplomacy, and the Canterbury's a great place. We had a 10 people turn up, and
yeah,
some people played double. It was great. A lot of new players, new faces. So it was really good.
I had a rough night, and it was very fortunate for me that I therefore did not have to play.
Yeah, actually,
I enjoyed very much sitting around watching football and encouraging other new players to.
Yeah, you
play
were just
Diplomacy.
A vizier. You people just came. You're like, I've got this thing. You're like, do this, don't do that.
Yeah. I was definitely the hungover godfather that day, and it was quite fun.
Yeah.
There were a few people that were playing for the first time. Some of Nathan's friends from school.
Some law students,
and they both did extremely well in the game. And I mean, I guess law students, so you unleash them on a board full of regular people, and all of a sudden,
maybe
was it that or that they were girls?
It was more that they were girls.
Okay. Well,
I mean, that wasn't it. I mean, I think lost it.
No, we're just that was cool. I felt like we created a couple of new fans of the game. Let's see. And so, speaking of other stuff around Seattle.
I'm sorry. Thank you.
Yeah.
You know, our tournament's coming up.
Yeah.
In January, and then it's I would say 90%. It's going to be the last weekend of January. I'm going to confirm that this Friday, and we'll get the details up on the website.
Yep.
So by the time people are listening to this, probably it'll already be up there.
Yeah.
Very, very good. It's probably, and I'm sorry I don't have the exact details yet because we've done a number of different ways, but it's going to be at least a 3-day tournament. We might do the Thursday Saturday thing, mm-hmm. and we might do the Friday Sunday thing. It'll just depend on what we think is best.
These things just kind of plan themselves nowadays. You've done how many of them now?
This will be the 8th whack.
8th?
Yeah.
I'm old.
Yeah.
I think it's
the 8th.
I think I've been at all of them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think you have.
Yeah.
Which means you, yeah, it is. Oh, it is good. I have to make sure, but I think it's going to be whack 8.
Mm-hmm.
Whacking.
Whack 8. Called Whack because it's held at the Washington Athletic Club, if
yes.
You guys didn't know, which is the awesomest space on Earth.
It is a very cool space.
So,
and it'll be, as far as I understand it, we're planning on the like classic Whack, which is like Whacks 3, 4, and 5, where we have the banquet and we have the whole pay for your food, and it'll have the entrance fee that's a little higher, like $70 or something like that. But we'll all those details will be figured out on Friday, and we'll get them out there.
Yeah, there will be more coming up, and we'll keep talking about it on the show because our goal is to make all of you, all 12 of you, or however many are listening, show up at our tournament.
Come on.
Anyway, all right, moving on. Let's do some emails.
Yeah, let's talk some emails.
Our first
email.
Oh my god.
Sorry, I really wanted to do that.
Yeah, no, it's okay.
Totally spontaneous, too.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure. Our first email comes from our pal Keegan in Christchurch.
Oh, Keegan.
Yeah, who, as listeners may recall, had a couple interesting things that we talked about a couple episodes ago, last time we actually did Hot Off the Press.
Oh, yeah.
And first of all, he follows up. He had written us about the Bohemian Crusher, and we talked. Yeah. We ended up talking for a long time about that, where you encircle Austria and smash him from above and whatnot. And we kept going, why in the world does Dip Pouch say that you're going to build in Rome after you're done with your Bohemian Crusher? And he basically just wrote and said, yeah, that build is intended for Venice. I really can't fathom why anyone would build in Rome in that situation. Just to follow up on that, at least most people, when they're talking about that, are apparently saying, unlike whoever wrote that article on the couch.
Equally so, flummoxed
as
to why you would do something like that.
Yeah, but then the other thing he followed up on was something else he had mentioned. There really were people on the show Survivor who really did play diplomacy a couple of years ago.
Yeah, that was really weird to read that article that he sent.
Their names, he tells us, are Stephen Fishback, Fishbach, and Jason, with a superfluous I, Jaison Robinson. A couple of seasons worth of these guys, I guess. He sent us a link to an article in People, so if you guys want to Google Fishback Robinson People magazine, you'll probably find this article. One of them had written this article, and it was like before the season started. But now, I want to go watch these episodes and see it, because they allude very specifically to the fact that they play this board game diplomacy, and there's this crossover. And I kind of want to gather some more information about this, see the episodes, see if people would recognize that, because that's a pretty mainstream crossover for us, and I think it's kind of cool.
Well, and there was definitely, back when Survivor was really big and just coming out, there were diplomacy players that were talking about sort of like the analogy and the similarities.
Oh, yeah, how you can sell the game to non-gamers by telling them that it's, you know, how on Survivor, how it gets all political, and the way that people make and break alliances on that show.
Yeah, and like that was an easy way for people to dial into it at the time, because it was just on everyone's, like, sort of the forefront of everybody's head.
Yeah.
So, it's interesting that I didn't realize that there was explicit reference within that show.
Exactly. I know they've had, like, pro poker players on there and kind of done the same thing, but wow, diplomacy. Uh-huh, cool. Yeah.
Well, thanks, Keegan.
Yeah, thanks for the email.
Now I'm smarter.
Yeah, definitely. Frederick writes, and to tell us that he started a new diplomacy zine. It's called Radar.
Radar Dip.
Yep. And it's at radardip.wordpress.com. We checked out the first issue of it. It's very short, as I would expect that a first issue is. But it looks like he sort of got a different, you know, a different bent than Diplomacy World, which is just sort of a, you know, I don't know, an omnibus. Yeah, a repository. Like, they'll print anything. They printed that Diplomacy Wing.
Which, seriously, crazy person wrote it. Not even kidding, guys. I'm in shackles here. I'm not, you know.
So, everybody, check out Radar.
Radar did.
Thanks, Frederick. Okay, let's see. Here's a little subject that we could talk about here. Will writes, just heard your episode 9. In addition to how to run a tournament, it might be good and interest more listeners if you talked about how to host a house game. Since we probably won't ever do a whole episode on that subject, let's take a few minutes here.
Okay, we can answer the question, sure.
Yeah, definitely.
So I think it's a bigger question than just hosting a house game.
Yeah.
I mean, there's really, well, you could... It's a meta question, really, because in order to actually build up to the point where you're hosting house games regularly, you kind of have to put a lot of legwork in.
Yeah.
There's a couple of articles out there, if you want to dig them up, that kind of go through a means of creating a community.
Yeah.
Some of them are really outdated, and they don't work.
Create a Prodigy forum.
And they're like, well, specifically, they're like, go to... There was a point at which email addresses were much less protected, like in the late 90s, and you could get them really easily. And now they're much harder to come by.
They're special treasures.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's really what it is. And if you go, another place to look to figure out more about this is to go to Jim O'Kelly's.
Yeah.
The Windy City Weagles.
Weagles, sure.
Weagles, he'll love that, by the way. Hi, Jim!
Yeah.
I love the Weagles. No, the Windy City Weasels. And he has done a lot of great stuff with Meetup. which has been a great vehicle for them. But really what you need to do is create a listserv and then just hound people and realize that people are flaky and you are going to need to put in 2 to 3 times more effort than at least than you think you're going to need to. Yep. You're going to need to remind people. You need to dog them until they sort of kind of, you know, create a community. So,
and I think that that's something that actually we will cover more, like sort of building your hobby in your city.
Which is a little bit more towards the tournament.
Yeah. But it you absolutely, I mean, the most important part is just make sure 7 show up, because nothing is worse than when 5 or 6 show up having arranged their entire day about playing Diplomacy, and then they either don't get to play or have to play a dumb variant or something that they didn't want to play. And so, like, so much of the work is just, you know, if you want 7, make sure that 11 people have absolutely sworn that they're going to be there, and you know, as recently as the day before the event, or whatever, because then somebody will oversleep and somebody, you know, whatever. But that's the hard part. The easy, fun part is the actual how to host a house game part. And there's a couple of things I guess we could say about that, just in terms of It kind of depends on exactly what your goal is with the house game. If it's something where you're trying to get and keep new Diplomacy players, and you're hosting it, and you know we're assuming you're the most interested in Diplomacy of the 7 people that are going to be playing there, or one of the more interested people. There's something to be considered in terms of how hard you play.
Let me cut to the chase here. Don't invite a bunch of your friends over and then destroy them at a game, because they'll never play again.
Yeah, and Diplomacy is particularly that way, because of the very specific kind of social nature of it, and the very specific, you know, the way that people end up feeling betrayed in games of Diplomacy, because, you know, you probably are betraying them and stuff. Don't just walk all over.
Yeah,
you know, it's they're like, we'll all make fun of you if you go, hey, we had a house game at my house with me and 6 guys that have never played before, and I soloed. Yeah, we'll make fun of you about it at tournaments later, because, I mean, okay, and congratulations on your big win, you know. Right. Did everybody else enjoy themselves, you know?
Are they ever going to play again, ever?
Mm-hmm.
Ooh. But at the same time, this is how we could talk about this for a long time.
Yeah.
You got to try and balance that a little bit.
Oh, sure. You don't have to act like an idiot on
your
board.
Yeah, and you don't want to set up an expectation where people start playing the game and they expect to win every time.
Also,
so you can create, like, you need to, people need to thicken the skin a little bit. You have to have, like, a little bit of, there's going to be a little bit of pain sometimes. Otherwise, they're going to experience that betrayal that you're trying to avoid in that first game, just 4 games in. And that doesn't really, you haven't really done anything then. You've just made all that much worse.
You know, the best piece of advice I think I've heard about it is let them pick fights with you.
Right.
You know, you kind of just hang out, play conservatively, do a thing, and then when somebody attacks you, it's a lot more understandable to them that you're fighting back, and you're better at the game than them, and so if they lose, they'll go, well, all right, this, you know, I got my ass fairly kicked by somebody who started a fight with me. If you just go, like, super aggressive and just do, like, your best game, you know, you pick your neighbor who's the next best at the game, and you go, let's just totally fool this guy, and that's not as fun. I mean, if you're hanging out, you're doing your thing, you're taking your neutrals, and somebody comes after you, well, you know, fight back, definitely. And if it means taking some people out, okay, you know. But
I do think that's the way I recommend.
Yeah.
I mean, so we've both done that.
Yeah. And then so that's part of it. And also, I guess some people sort of draw the countries out of a hat. Some people kind of like to give a break to people who are really, really new at the game, in terms of, you know, if a guy who it's his first game picks Austria or Italy, and you happen to pick France or something, you might just say, hey, it's okay, we can trade, as long as nobody else at the table objects to a trade. You can do that kind of thing. It's some of the more challenging countries. I know I played in a house game a little while ago where somebody who was her absolute first game ever played picked Russia, and
It's all right, but it's...
She had a really hard time with it. And that would be another one I'd understand trading. Austria, Italy, Russia, I'd understand trading. Like, if they get England or Turkey, that's usually not a bad place to start because it's hard to just get totally boat raced as one of those countries.
You're sort of up on in a balcony in a way, and you can observe the game, and you can see how the thing unfolds a little bit. So, and that's really what people need to sort of wrap their head around it. They need a game or two of that with a little bit of, success and a little bit of, failure. It's a nice mix. And I think the last thing you should always, let's say that you've gone over the, you've made it over the getting people there hurdle, which I promise we'll talk about in another episode. Yeah. We can talk very specifically and ad nauseum about that.
Yeah.
But once you get that over that and you've got the proper temperament, just remember that the house game is supposed to be fun.
Yeah.
It's not tournament play.
Yeah.
It's you don't need to have your game face on. It's supposed to be a little bit lighter and a little bit try to win, but maybe don't play an 18-hour game. Maybe.
Yeah. Right. Unless everyone's into it.
Yeah, sure. People are like, yeah!
That is something actually that you have to deal with a little bit more in house games is somebody just being like, I've really got to leave at 5.
Yeah, I got to go.
So house games are less likely to play out into a solo, I think, than tournament games. And if you're really just trying to grind out those two last dots, really, generally don't keep it fun. If you have sort of a group of people who actually are semi-experienced at the game or a mix of newer players and more, we have a lot of people who show up at our house games that have been playing for years. Usually there will be a couple of newer players mixed in. But when you get regulars, go at them.
Yeah, different game.
Have fun.
If you have
a regular bunch of people, I'd say anything goes pretty much. Just whatever's fun. I mean, those can be great. They can sort of be great, grudges that you take with you to tournaments, in a fun way. I don't mean evil grudges, but I just mean
that's
fun.
That's nice testing ground for some wacky ass thing you wanted to try.
Definitely.
You read about some,
Definitely, yeah.
Idiotic strategy, and you just want to try it out. Or you just, you woke up one night or played an online game, you're like, somebody just hosed you doing something, and you want to try it out. It's a great spot for that.
Yep. So we've touched on a lot of stuff there, and I don't know exactly what people would want us to be more specific about, but we can keep going with this topic.
If you have one more on it, also, if you're out there and you play a house game, and you don't know where to send the results to, feel like you want those results to be, recorded somewhere, there are people that record them for every house game on the planet.
Yep.
So you can send it to us at press and we'll get us to the right place and we'll connect you up with people. So if you need to, we'll reply back and, as we forward it to the proper authorities.
Yeah, right. Which there are.
I mean, some people are really into that. And I think that, while, it's easy for, Eric and I have been doing this for a really long time to kind of say, does it really matter? There's definitely, and maybe there are listeners out there like this that really like the idea of building up a score and comparing themselves to each other. And it'll let you, there's software out there that'll let you compare yourself to another player in the database. And you can look at your entire history on there and you can say, oh man, look, back here in 2005, I totally, just destroyed you. And, that's kind of fun every once in a while. So if you do want that, just feel free We know where to send that stuff, so just send it to us at press.
Nathan talks about that stuff like he doesn't care about it because he knows that he owns me. I care about it so much. Anyway.
I'm just being tactful.
Yeah, right. One more email I wanted to get in.
Okay.
It's from our contest winner,
from last
episode. He just wanted to tell us how that game actually did come out. I'm just going to read the first bit of it. He says, hi guys, what do you know? I won the contest. Thank you. I wrote you the mail and I actually feared you wouldn't find it so interesting because I was apparently getting the solo so easily, but when I heard you talking about the situation, I was actually laughing so hard I almost fell out of my chair. Strange what a different perspective will do. I realize now that this game was rather unique, because I usually try to talk to all the other players into attacking someone other than me, but I have never seen it work with literally everyone before.
Kudos!
He goes on and says, the game has already ended. I did get the solo, and I solved my dilemma between eliminating Turkey and stabbing Germany with the compromise of doing both. Good choice.
Yeah, bravo. I hope we recognize that.
Yeah. I did consider sailing against England. That was Matt's advice.
Oh,
attack
yes.
the one, like, who, I don't want to stab anyone else. And Matt was like, great, stab somebody else who's hard to stab. I did consider sailing against England for the final two, but communication was dying down a bit because some felt the game was going nowhere for them. So I decided to just wrap it up as quick as I could. All right. In the last few turns, I kept myself busy with trying to break up the EF alliance, you know, the only people who were seriously opposing it.
Yeah.
And making EG attack France just for the hell of it. Nice. I explained to them that they were obviously much better players than France, whose only accomplishment had been to take Spain and Portugal in 1901. Didn't mention their own inability to get their act together and fight me, of course.
That's because he's tactful.
Yeah.
And humble.
Yeah, definitely. It worked with England, but Germany didn't go for it, and again tried to take London in the same turn I took Berlin for number 18. Cheers, Bernard.
Yeah, no, that's really good. No, I'm really glad
well
it worked
done.
Out that
nice
way.
Well done, nice solo, yeah.
It's always good. And this is, you know, not to go on about it too much, but really great strategy. I mean, like, yeah. just keep, like, I really want, what I'm picking out of this and what I'm reading here, there's a lot yeah. of words here, but essentially what this guy did and what you guys should do is keep talking.
Yeah.
Always keep talking.
Yeah.
Even if you're winning, even if you're losing, keep talking.
Yeah,
you'll always
definitely.
End
and,
up better.
And especially if you really are trying to get 18.
Yeah.
You cannot give up on trying to sow discord in between the other people, because you won't get it.
And you'll never know.
As soon as you shut up and just sit there and write your orders, they'll go, well, geez, this guy's just trying to solo, and then they will bury the hatchet eventually. I mean, unless they're
totally incompetent,
or
which they might have been
angry at somebody or something.
Sure, there's insinuating circumstances, but really, keep talking. Just keep talking. So that's that's the little nugget you should get out of Bernard's devastating win here.
Yeah. Yeah.
Good.
Exactly.
Congrats, Bernard.
Here we go.
Power plays.
Yeah.
Power plays.
Power plays. We're back to this again.
Yeah, no, it's good. I wanted to get back to a little bit of strategy and a little bit less, Eric and Nathan's crazy adventures and doing, whatever it is we do.
Yeah, I don't know what we do either.
Yeah, but people
seem to like it.
This is the meat. This is the meat, the potatoes, and the strategy.
Yeah. So this particular subject, it sort of stemmed from, I think I said earlier, it stemmed kind of from a conversation that we had where we realized that how often you have that thing where there's a 1901, everybody does, like at a tournament, everybody does their thing, they take some neutrals, whatever, nobody does anything obviously insane.
And then 9 times out of 10, everyone is saying, I just want to wait and see.
Wait and see. Exactly.
Yes. And this is what they're waiting and seeing.
Right. And then what happens is the builds get down on the board, and then all of a sudden everybody kind of freaks out because somebody did something weird.
Yeah.
And that guy ends up being the target, and he ends up after the game going, what the hell happened? Why did everybody jump on me in 1902? What did I do wrong? And I think it's something sort of that... You know, if you're a newer player listening to this, we hope we have some advice for you.
Yeah.
If you're a more experienced player, this is sort of an interesting subject that I don't think gets talked about enough.
Right.
Like
what you're broadcasting.
What you're broadcasting, yeah. And I'm not even sure I understand a lot of it. The more I'm thinking about this subject, the more I'm just, like, kind of getting interested in, boy, what does happen in games where there's too many fleets built in O1,
sure.
or too many armies built in O1.
You start seeing how games are going to unfold when there's a fly in the ointment, for lack of a better analogy. When there's just an obvious misbuild.
Yeah.
The ripple effect of that, I mean, if you've played enough games, you can see it. You're like, oh, wow, in 2 years, this is going to be awful.
Yeah.
And there's just there's literally nothing that can be done about it. Like, it's just, there's no momentum for it, and you're just like, oh, man.
Mm-hmm.
So, when the it's interesting to really sort of highlight for a little, you know, more experienced players, like, you know, you're not only broadcasting something when you point it out, but, you know, it's influencing your decision making a lot.
Yeah, definitely. And it's something that you can exploit.
Exactly, when, just where I was going.
When other people do it, you can go, you know, like, let's say you're Austria, Turkey, and Russia, and then Turkey does something weird with his build. You can go to Russia at that point and say, look, this guy just totally misbuilt. We should go get him for that reason.
And you know he's predisposed to doing it.
Exactly.
So you have an advantage there. And I think a lot of newer, I mean, because your gut is like, oh my God, this is going to be terrible.
Mm-hmm.
But you definitely, especially if you know the person or you get a sense of them just from having conversations with them in the first two seasons, like maybe you're going to be able to work with them.
Yeah.
And I couldn't agree with you more. I think it's something that people really should be thinking about.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. Should we just go kind of country by country and talk about some common mistakes we've seen? Or you want to talk maybe a little bit about like what happens when there's too many fleets, too many armies?
Or just, yeah.
I'm waiting for you. I want you to
go. Eric is referring to is once again this game we had in Chicago, where I played Russia, and
sure, we could talk about this.
No, this is what
and
this
I was
is
Germany.
What, yeah, he was Germany, yeah. And what he's referring to is I had a, you know, a great opening, and I built, you know, as Russia, I built four.
Right.
He
took three centers and had a rebuild because they blew up the southern fleet.
Yeah, he blew up the southern fleet.
Yeah.
So I'm putting four down,
mm-hmm.
and I made a miscalculation in my 0-1 build. For one thing, I have four slots. I know I don't need another fleet. I just blew that one up, so obviously Army Sevastopol.
Army Sevastopol, obviously, because that would otherwise have defeated the purpose of blowing
up
the fleet.
Exactly.
You're going to do Army Warsaw, you're going to do Army Moscow.
So then the question is St. Petersburg.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking, okay, well, I'm building four, and I'm going to eventually need a fleet up there. I might as well put it down now, which was really sort of, I wasn't thinking, because what happened when I put that fleet down in North Coast
mm-hmm.
was it totally solidified Eric and his English not then yet ally,
tournament winner Chris Martin.
Tournament winner Chris Martin, as you interviewed, those two immediately were they might have been on the fence, but as soon as I put that down, they're like, "Whoa, okay."
Yeah, well, there's just nothing else we can do at that point. I guess the one other thing that could have happened is that Nathan and I could have come to me and said, "See, St. Petersburg, North Coast, let's go kill Chris." But I probably wasn't into it because you were giant and had armies right next to me.
Exactly. It was just a bad move. What I should have done, and as somebody pointed out, I think Chris, he was like, "Why don't you wave it?" I was like, "Oh, I don't know. I guess I could have done that."
Or built an army there and then just come after me.
Sure. I could have done that too.
Yeah.
But, you know, anyway, I don't want to get too far down that road because it doesn't matter, but you can see the impact of one.
Point is, it caused this chain reaction.
Ultimately led to the game winning alliance getting together and me totally just getting destroyed.
Yeah.
And that's one build.
Yeah.
So that's so I think it's really one of the reasons.
Do happen.
Yeah.
Well, all right. We started on Russia. Let's stick with Russia for a minute.
So my scenario does not come up that often.
No, you're not usually building fours.
No, it doesn't have to come that often.
The thing about, I guess the number one thing that I would say about Russia is you really are broadcasting a message when you build either fleet.
Yeah.
Or any of the three fleets, I guess I should say, North Coast, South Coast, or Sevastopol. Those are real deliberate, ooh, you better know what you're doing kinds of builds.
Yes, they're not a casual build.
Not a casual build. Nobody is going to blink. Nobody's going to think twice about any army that you build in any spot. Honestly, most of the time is Russia.
There'll be maybe a blink with Army North Coast. England won't be.
Army St. Petersburg North
Coast. Well, he's gonna say, you know, at least be like,
but that's a defensive build.
But he'll blink. He'll get some reaction. He'll say something.
Maybe.
But no one else is going to care but him. Yeah. No, I mean, nobody is going
to
care.
But it's much more defensive than either fleet.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean,
if you
feel like you have to have any interest up north, like, for example, and, you know, like, if you just don't want to, it's defensive in that it's just sort of a cagey, I don't want to get swallowed by an England-Germany, and I'm worried that there's some chance that that's going to happen.
I completely agree with you.
If it's your only build, it's kind of weird.
yes.
If you just got Romania, for example, and you're building one, and that's what you pick, that's kind of that's going to make people go, what the heck?
That would be a poor move.
Yeah,
unless there's some extreme circumstance.
But the fleet builds are extremely committal. St. Petersburg South Coast can't possibly be anything except for an anti-German move.
No, being, because in almost in most cases, you're adding a fleet to a front.
Exactly.
Because in almost, you mean, probably for most of you, you're going to have a fleet in the Black Sea or Romania, or maybe it's going to have to be one of those. I guess it could be in Armenia, but if you're building down there, it's in one of those three places.
People are afraid of Russia's with fleets, because usually Russia's, like, fleets are kind of a luxury for Russia.
Yeah.
When they start having them, it's probably because they're doing well, and people know that they need them, like, in sort of that really long-term solo kind of way. And so your fleets are going to spook people.
Yeah.
A little bit. So South Coast, extremely anti-German. Be sure you know what you're doing.
Yeah.
Be sure that, like, you have an ally and a plan. St. Petersburg, North Coast, even more so anti-English. There's nothing else you can do with that.
Yeah.
And then Sevastopol, pretty much totally anti-Turkish, right?
Yeah.
And also,
I mean, like, you can do an RT where you're pumping out fleets, but it's weird, and it's a waste of your time. Like, you shouldn't be doing that.
Yeah.
If that's your intention,
yeah,
there's a better distribution of resources there.
Yeah,
you can do it, but
you're gonna have to, like, walk things through Constantinople.
The only reason I put that caveat in there is that I have seen it.
So, and even if what you're thinking is well, okay, I'm fighting Turkey, I want to be able to have a support on the Black Sea or something like that. That's one of those builds that longer term is
kind of awful.
It can kind of break the game. For one thing, you're probably making yourself extremely vulnerable to Austria and to a lesser extent Germany.
Yeah.
Like, you're probably paying for it somewhere else and having one too few armies somewhere else and saying, come get me, in some way. For another thing, all right, so you get Black Sea. Now what? You use your other fleet to just sort of support it. Like, it's not really that good of an offensive build past the Black Sea.
Yeah.
So, I guess maybe if you've got three.
Yeah, I mean, and like, I've literally seen situations where people, there's, like, Turkey has three fleets on his side, and Russia has three fleets on his side. I mean, it's ridiculous. It's the worst use of resources.
You're both going to lose.
Yeah, you're both probably absolutely going to lose.
And so when other people see that fleet in Sevastopol, I think there's sometimes some sneering there.
Yeah, like, or at least I don't have to worry about that.
Exactly.
There's no way that I, as Austria, have to worry about a giant threat from Russia when it's building Fleet Sevastopol.
Yeah, exactly. If I'm Austria, I mean, I guess if I'm Austria and I'm just, like, locked into an early alliance with Russia, then I might say at that point, oh, that's great.
Sure.
Cool, another fleet. That'll really help us take apart Turkey really fast. But under ordinary circumstances, if I'm that Austria, I'm like, ah. Okay, what did he not build in exchange for building that? And how delicious does Ukraine look right about now? So I would say that's an eyebrow raiser for Russia.
Yeah. And as long as you, and the only other thing for Russia is if you're, because you're typically going to build one or two. Don't, as you kind of mentioned earlier, don't, like, build it on the opposite front of where you need it. Like, don't just put something down in a weird place. Like, if you're going and doing something, if you can get to Sevastopol or St. Petersburg or Warsaw, put it there rather than Moscow.
Yeah.
Like, you know, put it on the front line as much as possible.
Yeah. Well, on any darn front line, whatever.
And as long as, especially a front line that you're pushing on or threatened on.
If you have an arrangement with Austria, don't build in Warsaw, probably.
Yeah,
if you want him to like you, that's sort of an aggressive. I mean, that's sort of something else we can be talking about, is how people, like, might interpret your builds as an act of war in a way that you don't realize. I guess every once in a while I have these things where, you know, like in that example, like we're talking about an Austria-Russia alliance and I'm Austria and somebody just plops down Army Warsaw and I go, well, what were you thinking with Army Warsaw? You're just like, well, I don't know, it was open and I wanted an army. I'm like, okay, but you see how that's a bit of a threat to me, right?
I think that you can cover that with a fairly easy, like, sort of, you know, maxim, for lack of a better word.
Yeah.
Like, when you're putting down a build, don't just put it down because you have an open space. Like, think about how that build is first going to help you, and then think about, okay, do I have any alternatives?
Mm-hmm.
How will it affect my ally? Because you have to make sure that you are being supportive in that alliance, or you're going to undermine it and you're going to end up wasting time.
Yeah.
Because you have to, you know, try to backpedal out of it and explain it and say, oh, I wasn't thinking, like, and that's time you could be spending doing something else.
And I still might not believe you.
Right. And
that.
Obviously. Yeah.
So I guess Army 7, Army Moscow are the ones we're agreeing are completely uncontroversial.
Yeah, I mean, the only way Moscow, I mean, like...
No, Moscow's never controversial. Nobody cares if you build that.
Yeah, it is if you only have one, and you're, like, spread all over the place. You're, like, you have Sweden,
Romania. Oh, it might be bad. It might be bad. Oh, okay. It's just never controversial.
Fair.
And Army 7, pretty much the same thing. Yeah. I mean, everyone understands you're interested in the Balkans on some level, so I think that one's pretty much always okay, too. I mean, unless you have a Turkish ally who's very emotionally fragile, and you know, like, obviously Turkey, I suppose, would rather see you build Warsaw if you really do want him as an ally. But, I mean, I guess anything else kind of sends a message of some sort. All right.
I think the basic thing is, you know, watch the fleets, guys.
Yeah.
Think about it. Think before you fleet.
Yeah, definitely. They're very committal, and you better know what you're doing with them. Yeah. Okay.
We want to go...
Are we just kind of going in a circle around the board? We started with Russia, sort of completely at random.
Let's go counterclockwise.
Counterclockwise?
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
Let's go to England, just for fun.
All right, moving on. England. So England builds... Well,
see, England's fairly non-controversial because you have that wall of water around you. So people are really like less.
No.
There's only one thing that you can do that is committal and will send off alarm bells.
Flee Liverpool. Yep. That one, it can only ever be aimed at France.
Well, because it's just ridiculous otherwise, right? I mean, it's really hard to make a case. Like, well, I had three spaces, and I thought the one that's furthest away from the North Sea would be the easiest to do.
Right.
It's
a fine build if it's been accompanied by you convoying down to Picardy and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
You know, like, if you're just totally Frankicidal, then go for it.
Yeah, but I mean, you should be building two at that point. Never if you have a single build are you building Fleet Liverpool, because
your other one should be another army you're planning to convoy into.
Well, right. I mean, like, why? Yeah. It's just as fast to go Fleet London. Like,
correct.
Right? I mean, it's 01.
In fact, faster, but depending on exactly what your plan is and where the French pieces are. But yeah. So Fleet Liverpool is, the one that. I mean, if you really were planning on having, I mean, because stuff like this happens. I mean, it's like people like, well, I was planning on working with the French guy, but I guess he didn't like my build Fleet Liverpool. Like, these are the kinds of things I hear, like, from newer players at tournaments. So,
well, and newer players just get themselves into these situations where they promise not to build certain places,
mm-hmm.
right? And then suddenly they're like, I promised not to build in London, and I promised that I wouldn't build over here in Edinburgh.
Sure.
So it was the only place left, and not realizing that the entire board is going to go.
So we're just going to, like, for each of these as we're going around in a circle, we're just going to mention the ones that somebody's going to freak out if you do it. And so Fleet Liverpool, the French guy's going to freak out if you do that. If you really want it to be his ally, don't do that.
Okay.
the other ones, I suppose, are a little more subtle in terms of... because the fact that Edinburgh and London both border the North Sea means that both of both fleets in either of those spots, nobody really knows what you're going to do with them.
No.
The Russian guy might be slightly more nervous if you build in Edinburgh. The French guy might be slightly more nervous than you build if you build in London. But both of them are cagey enough that you could be planning whatever. Of course, we talked at length in the England episode about how you want to build armies as quickly and early and fast as you possibly can. I don't think armies are usually perceived as, like, super aggressive builds. I mean, I think most people know that you want to build armies. Army Liverpool is always a terrible build, and I want just out of that.
Well, I mean, like, there's just some... Right, and if you're only building one, and probably it shouldn't be an army, but if you're building two...
I've done it.
I mean, you can.
I've done it.
Depends. I've done it, too. I'm just... It's definitely easier in the beginning to have more flexibility with the other three pieces.
Yeah, pretty much very little that England does is going to be all that controversial. If you're thinking about what to build and you're not... I think I have trouble building as England a lot. I feel like I'm not sure what to build pretty often.
Well, it's because of the reasons you just mentioned. Like, it's sort of like, it doesn't really matter, so then you're sort of like, oh, well...
Yeah.
Because you... And I think this is, you know, implicit in what we're saying. Like, you're sending a message with that 01 build, and that message is going to reverberate for quite some time.
Yeah,
you want to make sure, you only have one chance to do it, right? So you want to make sure you're trying to deliver the good message to whatever strategy you've put together in the last two seasons.
I guess one thing to, well said. I guess one thing to consider is how, like, if how much you know about what you think the other people are going to build, if that makes sense. Because if, I don't know, if you think there's going to be a lot of fleets coming down on the board, you should probably be more inclined to build fleets than armies, because you kind of have to deal with that. If somebody's already just told you, or you just have a bad feeling that there's going to be a lot of
If things shook out anti-English, definitely build those fleets.
Exactly. Don't worry about your long-term plan to solo by cranking armies onto the continent, because you're not.
And you can always replace, if you want to like be the last man standing with armies on the whatever.
Yeah.
You know, you can always replace that as you go, and you get things piffed. I mean, like, don't start isolating yourself any faster than you need to.
So, but yeah,
a lot of gloom and doom there. So let's.
I think that's a good, I mean, I think I just learned a little something as I sat and puzzled it out for like 1 minute there, which is the better you feel like your start is going, the more inclined you should be to build armies.
Yeah.
I think.
Algebraically.
Well, I just mean, just kind of stop at the end of two seasons and say, how did that year go? Do I feel like I have a really strong ally? Do I feel like I'm not a target here? Do I feel like I can't? I mean, because armies are the more aggressive, sort of more optimistic build, I
optimistic,
guess.
Optimistic, yeah. Like that. I don't think aggressive is the right word, but I totally agree with optimistic.
So if you're feeling optimistic, build armies. If you're not really sure, build fleets.
And build two armies.
Because you probably can't convoy them anywhere.
Just be clear, so we're not giving bad advice.
Yeah.
All right, so the French.
Okay.
That's my favorite.
Yeah, because there's one big, fat, stupid mistake that you can make that people do all the time.
And I don't know why people do this.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess I can understand why people do this. They're afraid, they're feeling attacked, they want to fight back.
So let's say what this is that we're talking about.
Well, hopefully we're talking about the same this, because otherwise this will be awkward.
Two armies.
Yeah, two armies.
Yeah, two armies, no fleet.
Yeah.
Yeah. So a lot of times France builds two, and if he takes those two and just plops down two more armies for a total of 4-1.
They've broken the game.
Exactly. they kind of have.
The whole game goes unbalanced. It's awful.
Yeah. I would say sometimes the reason for it isn't just they're getting attacked or whatever. It's because they're attacking Germany.
Yeah.
And it looks good. Because you're thinking to yourself, well, Germany is right next to me by land. That's my only target. I'll need armies. But you don't. There's literally just not room for that many armies along your front.
You just can't get them through. And it's pretty easy for both the French and the German to just lock it. You only need three armies to lock that permanently. And you can slow it way down with just two.
Because specifically, I mean, at best, you're going to have two in, like, Picardy, Burgundy, or I suppose Belgium, Burgundy. And that's all that's useful.
Yeah.
But on its own for attacking Germany.
You gotta fight your way into Ruhr.
Yeah. And even under, like, while this attack is going great circumstances, you're in, like, what, Belgium, Ruhr, Burgundy. That's three.
And then you got at least one army just floating around doing nothing.
Just hanging out. Just because you're attacking Germany and Germany's next to you by land, you still don't need that other army. And now why don't you explain a little bit more about how it breaks the game apart? Because now you've got, in addition to your army that's just sitting there doing nothing, there's just the one fleet. And then what does that do?
So you have one fleet, and probably it's down in Iberia, right?
Trying to work its way back.
Maybe it's in Spain. Maybe it's in Portugal. But whatever you did, now suddenly both Italy and England have to look and go, wow, there is a complete power vacuum over to the west, or in the south as for the English player. The German is looking at this going, okay, I'm getting attacked, but I don't have to use all of my strength to do this. I could take half my forces and go into Scandinavia.
Sure.
And I can easily sell to both Italy and England, look at this entire power vacuum here is totally all golden for you.
Yeah.
Go for it. So what happens is, almost inevitably, the Italian, who is often finds himself quickly in a gridlock, is, you know, just pushed just enough to head west.
Mm-hmm.
He heads west. The whole east just starts going gangbusters because there's no counterbalance in Italy. I mean, literally, the whole game starts just, like, unraveling in these weird ways. and you can't stop it because there's no one in France. Mm-hmm. There's no fleet in France to do anything about it.
Mm-hmm.
And even when France gets a build again, it tends to not only be too late, but it tends to be that it doesn't get a build for like 2 years.
Yeah.
Because he can't get to anything.
Can't get to anything, yeah. I mean, unless he, like, his first two came from Iberia, maybe he forces Belgium.
Mm-hmm.
But then what?
Yeah, exactly. You know,
that's pretty ideal. That's assuming that, like, despite what he did, he's got England on side as an ally or something.
And he immediately loses him.
Right. Exactly.
Because, okay, you've built three, and then you've essentially just made, like, you know, Fort France. Mm-hmm. And people are like, really? Okay. This is going to be super easy. Because you have to remember that France is the guardian of that stalemate line.
So the alternative, then, is that you're not doing that.
We've gone on that enough. Sorry. Yeah. It's a little rant.
No, yeah. It's definitely... It is true, because it's something that happens often, and it's one of those things that just sort of, when we're on that board, we all just go, because it sort of writes a script about what's going to happen next, because there's just... Nobody seems to be interested in any of the water over there.
Yeah.
Now, the alternative to that is you do build the fleet.
Yes.
And when you build the fleet, you have a different problem, but a problem that you'd rather have, which is if you build it in Brest, the English guy is nervous. If you build it in Marseille, the Italian guy gets nervous automatically. And so it takes a little talking to, I mean, if neither of those guys is your target, like if your target really is Germany, but you're just building a fleet anyway, just to make yourself less tempting, that's okay. But whoever you want your ally to be needs to know that.
Yeah.
And they need to understand your reasons for doing it. And a lot of times what you end up doing is like a sort of better Fort France thing where you're parking one, say, on Spain's south coast and the other one in the mid-Atlantic and just saying, I don't even need these. They're just here to make me less tempting as a target. And because my three armies can do the job, as we already established, I don't need that fourth army to do the job of just attacking Germany. That's okay, but it's just healthier. You know, it says to England, we're working together, but go that way, you know, but can't come this way.
And it says to Italy, don't bother coming this way.
Don't bother.
It's going to be too much. It's going to be work for you. I can flip into the West Med in a heartbeat.
Yep. And you actually, if you do decide to attack Italy, you actually can't do that because Spain, South Coast to Gulf of Leon, Mid-Atlantic to West Med.
Exactly. It's flexible. It's much better. And it doesn't unbalance things in the same way.
So a lot of times if you just build that, like if you really want to show England all the love in the world and you do just build that one in Marseille, a lot of times Italy's not going to like it, but there's kind of nothing you can do about it after a while.
Yeah, and it helps too if that's what you've decided you're going to do. Just go to Italy and say, hey, I'm going to build this fleet down here, but I'm going to move it to Spain.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a lot of Italian players, they might say, well, I really don't like that. And you can say, well, I'm going to do it, and I just wanted to let you know first. And that's usually enough.
Yeah.
I mean, just, you know.
No, if you want to attack Italy right away, that's...
Yeah, so you could also do that.
Build it there and just go.
Right.
And, you know, and that's
fine. Sure. But that's the major thing. If you want to attack
England right away, you should... You know, there is one other thing.
Really?
Building both because you want to attack England right away. Also kind of weird.
Yeah.
Kind of an exotic, like, usually you're building one in one, but I guess you can do that. It's just the one in Marseille is so far away.
Yeah, it's far away, and it takes a while to get there. And you can still do it, but it does leave you a little vulnerable in at home.
Yeah. What if you only build one for some reason? Still the fleet most of the time?
Yeah, still the fleet most of the time. Because you know you're going to be able to pick up the other one with the fleet.
Yeah.
Like, you're probably in, you know, for whatever reason, you did something like... I don't even know what you would do. Maybe you just decided... I mean, like, maybe you're just ballsy and you just decided to forego Portugal.
Sure.
If you get... You know that if you get into trouble, you can fall back.
That's true. But on the other hand, I guess I could see it. Like, there is a point for a third army. Like, if you really are just targeting Germany and you're only getting one build for some reason...
Yeah, and
I could see three in one.
Exactly. And it's just not that
the fourth is pointless.
Well, and it, because you always... Because you have that extra Iberian center that you're going to get.
Yeah.
So you can you have something to do. You can go and get it. But like, what happens if you don't do that and you build two is there's no other option and you end up being ground down and you can never get out of it.
It does still create a little bit of a sucking vacuum if you don't build a second fleet, because then England is just like, wow, look at all that.
Look at all that water. Yeah. I'm going to need that water someday.
Yeah. So unless you're real, real sure about your English ally when you build one,
yeah,
still probably.
Probably, yeah.
All right.
Let's save Germany. Let's go to Italy, and then we'll come back to Germany.
Okay. I'd say something like 95% of Italian builds are one of two, right?
Yeah, totally.
Fleet Naples or Army Venice.
Yeah.
Army Venice is the sort of standard, I don't care about the ocean, I just want to kill Austria. And Fleet Naples is the everything else.
Right.
Basically.
And really, for Italy, like, you're just, most people make the right move because it's mostly intuitive.
Mm-hmm.
People aren't going to, like, put a fleet in Rome because it's just not near anything. I mean, you might, but the one thing that I have seen, and I'll let Eric describe this.
No, we're not telling the whole story. I know what you're going to say.
Just the Fleet Venice move should almost never happened.
Yeah, if you really are attacking Austria, you're almost definitely better off with Army Venice. and Fleet Venice is kind of one of those ones that makes everyone else on the board just go, huh?
Yeah, it's the type of move that will make you a target.
Yeah, I tend to agree.
Because it's just not good.
We're talking about Italy as if he always builds one. And I guess if you are building one, that's your decision. And the standard, nobody will ever look at you funny, build is Fleet Naples.
Yeah.
Right? Everybody thinks you're going to do that. Everybody assumes you're going to do that. Most Italians want to be a med power of some sort. If it's obvious that you and Austria are about to be fighting, Army Venice does the same thing. Obviously, if you don't want to freak out your Austrian, you probably shouldn't just build that. You know, like, if you want to be his friend, that's not a very friendly build.
And typically, if people get two, you see Army Venice, Fleet Naples. I mean, it's really...
Which is fine, or if you, you know...
Or maybe a double fleet sometimes.
Yeah, so that's the one I kind of wanted to talk about, that because I feel like that's one of the ones that kind of makes the game a little weird, too, is if the Italian builds it. Like, sometimes I'll see maybe he takes Tunis, but he also takes, like, Munich.
Yeah.
Sort of flugally or something, and then builds two fleets. That can work, but it's one of those ones that kind of makes the board go, whoa, what's going on there? Two fleets, you know. For one thing, you're probably going to lose one, you know, unless you have a good plan, because you won't have enough to hold Munich at that point.
Yeah, probably. Or if you pick something up from Austria, you're not going to have any, you won't be able to hold it.
Right.
So that's the thing. And then you turn into this, like, three fleet power or two fleet power and an army. Like, it's strange.
Yeah.
And you tend to, like, the tendency is to kind of, like, either go after, hopefully you're either going after one of the other ones, either France or Turkey, and it tends to accelerate. It's a mid-game moment that happens in 01.
Exactly.
And so it unbalances things a little.
Yeah. Building two and building two armies, I guess, is understandable.
Yeah.
Because, like, let's say you took Tunis and also grabbed Trieste off Austria, then you're probably building Army Venice, Army Rome, and just keeping at it.
Yeah, you're just going to plow.
Yeah. That's pretty normal. Fleet Rome as your only build is just bizarre. But
see, no one would do that.
And that's not true.
Well, see,
we're trying to cover the ones that are weird and make it...
Yeah, people would not understand it if you did it. They would think you were very anti-French.
And the reason is because Naples doesn't really announce anything. You can go Tyrrhenian, you can go Ionian, you can do whatever you want with Naples, whereas Rome can just go Tyrrhenian, and so you're sort of declaring to the board, my only possible thing that I might do here is go west.
Yeah.
And so like, let's say if you took Tunis with the fleet, then really your only moves, if you build Fleet Rome, are like Tyrrhenian and west.
But, and there's, I guess, the only scenario I can think of in which that would work, it just occurred to me, like, if you were, if you're in Piedmont, and, like, you've just decided you're going west, and you want the whole board to know
that's
what you're doing, because maybe you have a great alliance with Turkey or something.
Yeah.
That could serve.
Yeah, it's sort of an announcement to the board, but just understand it is an announcement to the board. Yeah. Army Naples, I don't get why you'd do that. Army Rome as your only building.
Well, you
could, why
you'd
do that.
If you would do Army Naples if you've taken the Ionian and you convoyed to
Tunis,
and then you wanted to
an extra convoy.
Yeah, or maybe you haven't convoyed and you want to convoy to, like, Apulia. Mm. Yeah. Not cool yet. Albania.
Yeah.
Maybe you have like some plan. I don't know. You could do it. I've done that one before.
Sure, but you can only convoy one at a time, and you should still have an army from 1901 left over to convoy somewhere. Anyway.
No, have you seen how I play Italy?
Yeah, I suppose. Let's just leave it at the short answer is Army Venice is always fine, basically. Fleet Naples is always fine, basically. The other ones are sort of exotic.
And never build Fleet Venice.
And right, because why?
Please don't.
Yeah, if you want to be in the Adriatic, you should probably be set up to already get there some other way. And anyway, it makes the board go, huh? We can do that. But I guess now that we've been through this, there's a lot of Italian builds that would make the board go, huh? But they'll almost never seem like a good idea, so don't worry about it.
Yeah, I've just seen the Fleet Venice build actually go down, so...
And the whole board went, huh? Yeah. It was a board Nathan and I were both on.
It was pretty funny.
And sure enough, everyone was just like, what the heck were you doing? And then they eventually killed him. All right, Austria?
Sure, let's go Austria.
I don't know why you're saving Germany for last, but we've encircled Germany, so let's just stick with it.
Yeah, encircle Germany, then go west, then go east again.
So. Yeah, sure. Austria, not a ton to say about Austria, because they're just all armies, and people usually do it right, just because they put them where it seems like they need them.
Yeah.
If you're nervous about Italy, you put one in Trieste. If you're nervous, you know.
Sure.
More normally, you put them in Vienna and Budapest and whatever's open. I say only armies because in 01, a fleet is almost never going to happen.
And you just won't do it.
That would be the one that would be it. Like, even if you are nervous about Italy,
don't build
it. You're still better off with an army for defense. The fleet would just be like, I guess maybe if you built three and you were just feeling your oats a little bit and it just felt like everyone around you was your friends or something like that.
Yeah, but they're not, because the only way you get three
is if you really upset somebody.
Well, you're taking Romania. That's the only way to do it. Really. Yep. Or Venice.
Yep. All right. If you somehow... How did you get Venice, though? I mean... I guess you walk Vienna to Trieste, Trieste to Venice.
Yeah, I mean, that's the only way to do it. I mean, like,
awesome.
It would be terrible. But if you're building three, you piss some people off, and you probably don't want to build a fleet. I have seen it. I don't know if I've actually ever seen a fleet Trieste go down in 01.
In 01, yeah. It would be a mistake.
Yeah.
It would be that one build that makes the board go, whoa, and target you.
Yeah,
probably.
If you weren't already a target.
Under ordinary circumstances, if you built three, maybe not so much, but if you built one or two and you built a fleet, that would just be a goofy build that would make the board go, ooh, Austria doesn't know what he's doing, I think. There's not a ton of difference between Budapest, Trieste, and Vienna in terms of, I mean... I guess the only thing would be if you pre-agreed with your Italian ally that you're never going to build anything in Trieste, and he's never going to build anything in Venice, then you should not build anything in Trieste if you plan on sticking to that. But between Vienna and Budapest,
No one's really going to... Just especially in 01. Like, no one's going to care.
You'll almost definitely build in Budapest and somewhere else.
Yeah.
If you got two, like, if you got one, it should probably be Budapest. If you got two, it should be Trieste and Vienna. Or one of Trieste or Vienna, along with Budapest.
And like we said, like, you're probably just getting pressed from some direction, and you're just going to make the right move anyway. Yeah. So, I mean, Austria's not really a place where people make weird builds.
Other than the fleet, I feel like there's nothing that would make the board go, huh?
So, but Germany...
Oh, okay. You want to save Turkey for last.
Yeah, because...
You're so confusing. I feel like I'm going to pass out.
Yeah. Ooh, man. It's all that sauerkraut.
Yeah.
So, Germany.
Yeah.
It's a country that has some builds. That actually, probably one of the countries that you get three builds the most.
Yeah. Probably. I'd say.
Probably
not that it happens all the time, but yeah, I'd say.
And really, it's hard to go wrong.
So, Germany, I guess, has a lot of permutations in that, like, a one-build Germany wouldn't be shocking, a two-build Germany wouldn't be shocking, and a three-build Germany wouldn't be shocking.
Yeah.
So we need to kind of talk about all of that.
Well, you should try and build... I mean, I think the general maxim, and we've talked about this in the Germany episode, you should try to build a fleet, if you can.
Yeah.
If you can. Now, if you're only building one, you probably shouldn't build a fleet.
It. Yeah. Okay. I don't even know if I agree with that. All right. Okay. We may have some little dust up here on Germany.
Hey, I don't play Germany that well. You play them better than I do, so I'll defer to you on this. But I do think, like, if you overcommit yourself with armies, you just...
Okay. Well, what's your plan with the fleet?
It'll depend on the game. Like, I probably will want to go... If I am totally solid with England, I'll probably still want a Scandinavian presence.
Right. That's usually what a German fleet is for, is Scandinavian. Or you're totally anti-English, and you just... Here's the mistake that I see people do. They build two, you know, like they get the common, like Holland and Denmark or something, and it's sort of the reverse of the France thing we were talking about. They've made up their mind, England is my target, and so, bam, bam, two fleets.
I don't agree. I don't think you should ever build two fleets.
You should almost never build two fleets because you can't really use them all. And it's one of those things that creates that sort of same sucking sound where all of a sudden, well, now what are you? You're three fleets, two armies.
Yeah.
And you're Germany. And so there's just this hole in the middle of the board where all of a sudden, you know, France and Russia and whoever are just like, whoa, he really can't defend Munich.
Nothing. And he can't make progress against England very quickly.
Exactly. Because you're going to put, best case, you're going to put one in Helgoland and the other in nowhere.
You'll probably put the other one in Baltic and then just try to press on the Russian.
Right. So now you're starting a two-front war.
Yeah.
To start a one-front war with England.
Right.
So I would probably like, in the common circumstance where I wanted to attack England, I'd probably just build a fleet Kiel and then maybe Army Munich for defense or something like that. Or, you know, even Army Berlin is fine. It doesn't matter that much. But if my sole target is England, I'm still probably just building one and one.
Right.
And I do see people do that, and I do think it's a mistake, and I do think it calls attention to you when you're Germany and the other people on the board are like, whoa, two fleets and that's all, huh?
Yeah, I totally agree with that.
It's probably the biggest mistake you can make.
I can only think of that. Like, I'm trying to think of another thing that you could do that would really throw people off, other than just building in the face of circumstance that seems odd. Like, we can't really
talk about that. I guess even if you're building three and you were just like army, 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 I don't think people would think that was bad.
No, I don't think. I think it limits you in a way that
it
you does. Might not
it
want,
it kind of is bad. Just in terms of, oh, that's too bad. You really didn't want to flee anywhere in there. But again, it does depend on your target. Also, I think the where you're building a fleet, you know, Fleet Kiel like is definitely your most versatile build. It's your most useful build. It can go to the Helgoland if you are wanting to do something anti-English. It can go to the Baltic. Fleet Berlin is another one of those, kind of like Fleet Rome. It's
sort of like, hey, Russia.
Or hey, England, look, I'm really with you. This can only be attacking Russia.
Yeah.
And you know, the Russian will hate that.
Oh, absolutely.
So if you're going to build a fleet, which you sometimes should anyway, or pretty often should, probably just put it in Kiel. It doesn't tell anybody anything, really. I guess where I'm disagreeing is there's a lot of times when armies are fine. Where I'm just building armies in a while.
I should qualify. When I say try, I mean, I'm not making it an imperative. Mm-hmm. I just think that generally in O1, unless you're lucky enough to have, like, really solidified up an alliance in those first two seasons, you need to have a little bit of flexibility.
Yeah.
If England opened the channel and he and France are just like at each other and you don't really know which one of them you're going to attack, he might want to throw that fleet down.
Oh, sure.
If France is just gone after you and England's some at least helping, build all armies, defend yourself, and it might not.
Yeah, the one thing that it really does limit is it limits your progress in Scandinavia.
Yeah, absolutely. You're done.
Yeah, exactly. And if that's what you want, like if you're kind of trying to come up with some, I mean, every once in a while I have these games where like England and Germany and Russia are just like, we each got our one dot in Scandinavia, now let's all just back off.
Yeah.
That's great if you can manage just not have a northern front, but usually you will.
Yeah, almost always.
And obviously the armies, like if you get two and you put them in like Berlin Munich, as opposed to say Kiel Munich.
Yeah.
Be aware that the Russian is not going to be crazy about that one, because you could be coming in O2 really easily, and he might see it that way. Army Munich is never one that anyone's
going to... Oh, no, it's so standard. I mean, like, it's generally the first thing you put down. I mean...
Yeah, if you're building one, probably something went wrong in 1901, and you probably need that Army Munich pretty bad. I mean, unless you were doing some, like, wacky gambit with France that meant that you didn't care, in which case you're building a fleet, and that's why, you know, like, you can do these things with France where you're like, I don't even need Denmark or whatever, and I'm just going to build another fleet.
To wrap up Germany, so we're not wandering too much here, mm-hmm. unless you're not going to do too much there that is really going to make people think you're crazy, because it's so circumstantial. You're right in that center. But if you build those two fleets
when you only built two is
one of those things, like, people are going to, it's going to send off alarm bells, and you will attract attention.
Mm-hmm. And Russia will consider it pretty hostile if you build Berlin and Munich.
I know everyone's going to be mad at you. Like, no one is.
Oh, no. I just a second point was, if your two builds go in Berlin and Munich, understand, like, whether they be armies or fleets, understand that the Russian isn't going to be crazy about that. Some German players don't realize that particular point. Anything in Kiel, anytime, everyone is going to think is fine.
Kiel and Munich.
Munich, yeah.
So you're only, like, Berlin is the only space where you build something and people are going to
raise eyebrows.
Yeah, exactly. And feel threatened by it.
Although, I guess, if you build Fleet Kiel having, like, sworn eternal allegiance to England, I guess maybe he's not going to be too crazy about that, in which case build Fleet Berlin.
But even then, you can sell that.
Right. Moving on.
Last one, Turkey.
Yeah,
See, kind of went full circle.
No, we didn't do anything of the sort. We went in a spiral and then added Turkey onto the end of it.
Yeah, but now we're right next to where we started.
You're terrible.
Stop mocking my inability to recognize geometrical shapes.
Fine. Turkey, I remember actually we talked quite a bit about the mistakes you can make as Turkey in 01 in our Turkey episode, because you felt really, really strongly about how you can break a game with the wrong Turkish build. Well, I guess we talked more about the wrong Turkish opening, but you can break the game with the wrong Turkish build.
It's true.
The second fleet on the Black Sea would be a big one. It's one of those ones that calls attention to you, and you'd better be sure about this, because it's you've lost all interest in the Balkans and the Mediterranean.
Yeah, it's
when you
just
do that. In your hatred of Russia, you have thereby announced that you never have interest in any center except for, like, Romania and Sevastopol.
It's just so bad.
It's usually bad.
It is. It is pretty bad, because in order to fix it, it takes a year to kind of, like, flip everything around, and by that time, people are all up in your grill.
And we're mostly talking about Fleet Ankara here.
Yeah.
Because Fleet Khan can do a little, like, helping on the Black Sea and then leave.
Right.
For the love of God.
Please get into the Aegean.
Yeah. Not that every Turkish, like, the only successful Turkeys go into the Med as fast as possible, because they don't. Like, sometimes you have to fight Russia. But be really, really sure that you absolutely, there's no other way to ever get the Black Sea than to build the second fleet on Kara before you do it.
Right, because it's 01, and you probably only are picking up Bulgaria. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's because that's what you do.
Mm-hmm.
Unless you got lucky. So there's something sitting in Constantinople almost always.
Yep.
So you really are choosing between Ankara, which is how you get that thing in Ankara, or Smyrna. And seriously, guys, just build in Smyrna.
Yeah, I think an army Smyrna is usually a better anti-Russian build than a second fleet in Ankara.
Now that I think about it, you probably have... The only way Ankara is open is if you've got the Black Sea.
If you've got the Black Sea, in which case it's probably, I mean, you're building that second one just to try and hold the Black Sea while you do something else, which is, I mean, if you got it, I don't know, there's probably something better you could be doing. Like, I usually like Army Smyrna. If I'm attacking Russia,
because flip that up into Armenia,
exactly. Yeah, because then I have the supported attack on Armenia, or the one, you know, the unsupported move to the Black Sea on Armenia, and he doesn't know what I'm going to do.
Yeah,
at that point, if I'm fighting the Russian, like, the game's not usually as fun anyway. But
but you understand how, like, that fleet in Kara tells the whole board, this is what I'm doing.
Yeah, the Black Sea is my only long-term target and the only thing that I really care about. It's a real committal. The only reason I'm not saying never do it is, like, I feel like maybe there's a time or two when I've just felt, like, so backed into a corner by my situation that I'm like, God, this is the only thing that works. I know he's about to build Fleet Sevastopol because he's an idiot, too. And, you know...
Because I like the two.
Yeah.
In addition to me.
Right, exactly. So, I mean, I guess I've had those games, but just understand that it's, like, the most insanely committal, like, I don't care about anything else that Turkey's supposed to care about.
Yeah, and you're definitely getting a reaction from the board. Like, there's going to be, like...
So don't just do it because you're fighting Russia.
Yeah,
please don't. There's plenty of more flexible things you can do that are fighting, perfectly useful fighting Russia moves, but aren't just totally crazy. I mean, hell, Army Ankara, if you've got the Black Sea.
Right.
Maybe you could convoy. Right. Unless he actually has two on the Black Sea himself, which he won't already, then now you've got some convoy options. Now you've got, you know, some supported attack on Armenia option. The army is the better way to go if you're anti-Russian, almost always.
No matter what you put.
The Fleet Smyrna is probably the most common when the Turk builds one.
Yeah.
It's probably the most common because...
It's most defensive.
But the one thing about it is that the Italian never likes it. You probably don't care about that. Most Turks don't.
No, he doesn't like it. What you want to do, even if you, like, if you're a typical Turk, you probably don't have a lot of pressure on you in 01. Like, just build Fleet Smyrna and park it in the Aegean, and then just make it clear to Italy. Any of your little shenanigans over there where you're trying to come up under my underbelly, not happening. And that's it. And then you'll, trust me, a threat will materialize, and you'll be able to use that fleet in a useful way.
One thing I do, and I think I actually mentioned it in another episode, one thing I do that it just sort of as a kind of like, let's see if Italy's really serious about actually having long-term peace with me, is I always say, because the thing when you're a Turk that you don't want is for him to be setting up that whole Lepanto move and convoying down to Tunis. The thing I always... kind of like float out there is, well, hey, if you want to take Tunis with the fleet instead of convoying your army down there, I'd be willing to not build Fleet Smyrna. Like, I'll build something else instead.
Sure.
And then you can actually, you know, stick to that and build a little of that goodwill in there, because just sort of him taking Tunis with the fleet, building Fleet Naples, and while you take Bulgaria and then build Fleet Smyrna, it's never going to be good between you and the Italian after that. Like, so that's the one that I'd say you got. I mean, even Fleet Khan, although it kind of accomplishes the same thing.
Well, it's hard to do, though. Like, you have to pre-plan that.
If Khan happened to be open.
Yeah, right? You have to pre-plan that, like, where are you going to put Smyrna?
Right.
Right? I mean, like, you have to be pretty confident that you're going to the black, otherwise you're going to end up with Khan open, Army Smyrna, Fleet Ankh, which I guess all right.
At least it's not as just hopelessly anti. And I say anti-Italian, but I mean anti-Austrian kind of too. Like, if you're just doing like, if you're talking seriously about doing an AT alliance, he doesn't want to see Fleet Smyrna.
Not particularly.
No, he wants to see you build an army.
Right.
Because then you're serious about this, like, working with him, which probably involves attacking Russia somewhere in there.
Hopefully, generally.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there's this sort of four-way dynamic that happens in the East where you can kind of be friends with one guy plus another guy who's fighting your friend. And it's sort of
like have these little, like, not quasi-alliances, like, I'm with you, buddy, I just can't yet.
Yeah. It depends. I mean, okay, if you intend to be working with the Russian, Fleet Smyrna is always what the Russian's going to want.
Oh, yeah.
It's always a good move if you really are intending a juggernaut. Let's start there.
Yep.
There's almost no other build that's really all that great. I mean, I guess another army con to be doing some Vulcan thing. But Fleet Smyrna is the right move,
right?
Almost always in an RT because it gets done. You know, it's the direction you should be going is into the med with fleets. In a Turkey Austria alliance, probably some kind of an army is going to make him happy. I mean, I suppose he'll probably be happy too if you build a second fleet on the Black Sea, because then he's like, oh, you're really committed to this.
Yeah, no. But don't do that.
Yeah, exactly. And if you're having a Turkish-Italian alliance, you should build an army, too.
Yeah, pretty much it.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's a little around-the-world tour. I hope that was helpful.
Yeah.
Because really our goal here, like we say before, is like try and give you information about what will make the board react to you and make you a target.
Yep.
And what will sort of... How people will react to your builds.
What they're trying to do. It's like the thing that Nathan often reinvents about when you sit down at the table and you haven't spotted the sucker.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're the sucker. Like, one way of identifying yourself as the sucker is just, like, building something that you didn't really think about. And that's it.
Yeah.
Final thoughts?
No, I don't really have any final thoughts. Here's my final thought.
Okay.
If somebody has an idea about this particular thing, if there's something you've seen that really epitomizes what we've talked about, we'd love to hear that story. Or if you just happen to have an experience that or a view on like what you should really build in 01 in a particular circumstance, we'd also love to hear about that.
Yeah, or even a hey, I made this somewhat unusual build. Is this one of those builds you guys are talking about that made me look like an idiot? We love those stories too, for sure. Those kinds of
That's the only thing I have. And I hope it was helpful. If it wasn't helpful, let us know, because we have some plans to do something similar to this up in future episodes. So let us know and we'll come up with something else if it sucked.
And that was Power Plays. Coming up next, Jerry Fest. Maybe we'll ask him about idiotic things he's seen other people do.
I'm sure he'll have an opinion on that.
Oh, yes. Joining us now from Portland, Oregon, via Skype, is...
The amazing.
The incredible.
And tiny.
And tiny, gnome-like, elder statesman of diplomacy. Wait, you got any more?
No, I was done.
No, okay.
The elder statesman of diplomacy.
Our friend...
Jerry Fest.
I was going to say Jerry Fest.
You can say JT.
JT. JT Fest.
Yes.
What's the T stand for, Jerry?
You want me to tell you that publicly?
Well, yeah, you're in public now.
Actually, the T stands for a British royalty, Thane.
Oh, drag.
Oh, nice. Thane. I did know that. I had forgotten that. I had forgotten that. Jerry, thanks for spending a few minutes with us today.
Oh, my pleasure. And, you know, we're already 2 minutes into this, and I've already been called short and old for this.
At this point, you know, just for our listeners out there, Eric and I have known Jerry for well near a decade now, and I think it's almost like a greeting, like, you know, like this way that we're supposed to talk to Jerry is...
We forgot irrelevant. Short, old, and irrelevant.
No, Jerry's not irrelevant.
Yeah, no. Irrelevant. He's still, well, for this half hour or so.
He is.
He's a superstar.
He is. I mean, now he's on the internet. He is famous now.
That's true. All right.
So, Jerry...
let's talk about diplomacy.
This whole episode's about Spring 1901 builds, and...
I'm going to take this opportunity to correct you and say that you don't usually build after the spring of 01. So
I'm really good at diplomacy.
Yeah, okay.
Fall 1901 builds. 01 builds. Let's just call it 01 builds. The season really, I mean, implies...
Sure.
Yeah.
That way you don't have to get confused between spring and fall and you know how confusing that can be.
Yeah. You know, I think one of the great things, listeners, is one of the reasons we're having Jerry on here is really just so that he can make fun of us, which is really our primary motivation. He doesn't really even want to be here, but he's doing us a favor.
Getting our ours in now.
Builds, Jerry, is there any advice for our listeners out there on whether or not they should be building X, Y, or Z in any particular way? Any sage advice there, or are you gonna punt on that one and we'll talk about something else?
I may punt on that one a little bit because, you know, I don't know who's listening to these podcasts. My guess is that a lot of the people listening to the podcasts are quite experienced and know a lot about 01 builds. I think the thing that I always pay attention to when I'm on a board with people is who does consider 01 builds or not, because newer players, they tend to not think about the builds until it's the build phase. And then suddenly they're going, oh, geez, what do I build?
Right.
That's when they make their mistakes, because I don't think they realized how significant in terms of the communication to the rest of the board an 01 build is.
Yeah.
Sometimes it doesn't really matter what unit you're putting down. It matters what message that sends to the other players. And I think that's completely missed by new players.
Yeah.
So, it sounds like your advice is to, if there are, because we do have quite a few new players that do listen, your advice would be talk to someone about what it is you're going to build, or at least have that somehow be built into your negotiation. Is that what you're suggesting?
Yeah, that's absolutely what I'm suggesting. I think the O1 builds are sometimes more important than the spring and fall O1 moves. And I've seen a lot of new players talk about getting the dots. You know, am I getting 2 builds? Am I getting 3 builds? But they don't talk about what they're actually going to plop down on the board.
Right.
I think that's the conversation that you need to start having in the spring with your allies and your potential enemies, just to make sure that you're not miscommunicating. Because I've seen newer players actually get involved in a war with another player that they had absolutely no intention of getting involved in.
Yeah.
They threw down a build and the other player said, fleet? Okay, I'm coming after you.
Right. It's a good point. It's something that we sort of kind of edged around before, but we hadn't talked about it exactly there. The accidental war that you can just start with your builds. Or come to think of it, the intentional wars that you did. Sometimes we'll talk about the build stab, where, you know, you're working with someone from 1901, but then you plan on stabbing them with your builds, which can work too because of the, you know, there's the simultaneous nature of building there. You can, you know, that Fleet Liverpool comes down at a time when France was fully planning on doing something completely different. That can be a pretty pretty good war starter right there also.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's good that Jerry articulated what I don't think we articulated particularly well, which is, hey, newer players, or even experienced players, pay attention to what it is you're doing during negotiations, because you're sending such a big message with that.
And if you're not sure, ask someone, you know. In fact, even ask someone on the other side of the board who probably doesn't care what you do if you're not sure. So people will tell you,
right, but just remember the advice they're giving you is the advice that's in their best interest.
Oh, of course. That's why I was saying try and find someone if you're new and you're England, maybe just ask the Austria dude, hey, what would you build here? You know, just or conversationally. Something. And he'd have to be some kind of Jerry Fest-like evil character. Machiavellian to actually, think the 20 moves ahead. What do I want England to build that would help my game and screw up?
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah, I think the most important thing to remember, especially for new players, is there's really two sides to this game. There's the diplomacy side, which is the more important, and then there's the tactical side. And what I've seen new players get into with their builds is they're only thinking in terms of tactics. Mm-hmm. And what they really need to remember is build signal information to other players. Mm-hmm. And you really have to think through what is the message you want the other players to be receiving.
Well, and you know, this crosses over really well, not only for, you know, tournament play and, you know, face-to-face play, but it also translates maybe even more profoundly in online.
But in online, you can negotiate during the builds phase, can't you?
Yes, you can.
That's a big difference right there.
That is
actually
a big difference.
Something we didn't talk about yet. But
you also, you know, actions really speak quite loudly on online. Because, you know, whatever is going, you know, emails are so well crafted and thought out. But when you actually put something down on the board, it's like, oh, okay, I might have been misreading this guy. This is clearly what happens. I mean, I know, Jerry, you've done both. Do you think one is more important than the other, or do you see a difference?
The versus email versus face-to-face?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think the difference with email is you do have more time and you can negotiate more, but it still gets down to what is the message you're sending to other players. And this is this is another thing that I think new players can't even conceive of when they'll see an experienced player actually waive their builds, not put anything down.
Right.
You know, why would you do that in a tactical game? Well, it's because the tactics isn't the game. It's diplomacy that's the game.
Right.
There are some times where it may be better to not put anything on the board than to risk making your ally nervous.
Have you ever waived anything in 1901?
1901, let me think.
I'm just trying to think if I ever had.
I should have.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think there was actually a time when I was playing France where I got 3 builds and I waived one because I had a new player in Germany. We were going against England, and I didn't really need the extra build, and the credit I got with the German player by not being stronger than him went further than putting down another army with.
Yeah, yeah, that makes sense. I guess it's something we didn't talk about at all, but it's, I suppose there's situations. I think...
Yeah, it's got to be pretty rare, but...
Seems to me Chris Martin had some story about just waiving everything in 1901 because he didn't want to scare everyone.
Yeah, I'm sure. And whether or not that actually happened is another whole fairy tale right there.
Right.
Might have. It wouldn't surprise me. It would not.
Seriously, who would be scared of Chris Martin?
I don't know. I don't know. He's been on the show a couple of times.
He seems like such a lovable guy. Like win tournaments and solo and stuff all the time. Whatever.
I was sort of trying to segue us towards your email and online sort of experiences. Do you have, after, I think you've been doing it for, correct me if I'm wrong, many years, both, you did a number of years, both online and in person, right?
Right.
So, having done that, I mean, is there any advice that you would have for someone that is trying to move from one venue to the other? Like, if you're coming from I know that we typically think online to face-to-face, but it could go the other way as well. Is there any advice you have as somebody that's really spent a lot of time doing both?
Well, it's easier to go from face-to-face to online, because face-to-face, in my opinion, is a much harder game. For one thing, you've got all the time constraints, which a lot of people, especially if they're used to playing online, just the idea that you can't sit there for a couple of days thinking about what you're going to say really blows their mind. They often get really trapped in getting their orders and things like that. But also, you have a lot more to work with, a lot more to consider when you're playing face-to-face, because, you know, to get out of the game world and just get into human interaction, you know, so much of our communication is nonverbal.
Right.
And when you play online, you eliminate all that nonverbal communication. The only communication you have is what's written in the email. Now, that has pluses or minuses, because I think some people don't consider how easily it is to misinterpret what somebody wrote. It's hard to get the right tone. It's hard to get the right message across in email. But the good news is you have way more time to do it. If there is a misunderstanding, you can talk it through. Face-to-face, you're getting all this information coming at you, and the smallest amount of information that's really worth a damn is what they're saying to you.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You have to be looking at the body language, you're looking at the verbal cues, you have to be paying attention to really, when you're negotiating with somebody face-to-face, you're also paying attention to who is talking to who else elsewhere in the room, because that's all information that you've got to put together to figure out who's lying to you. So I think the amount of information that you have to sort through, combined with the shortened time that you have to sort through all that information, really makes it difficult to go from email to face-to-face, but it's a lot easier to go the other way.
But then I guess I'd add one caveat to that, which is that with all of that information that you're trying to learn to sort through when you're going from online to face-to-face, everybody else is having the same problem. And so the game, you know, obviously people who are more experienced at the face-to-face game are able to, you know, get better at sorting through all that information in a short period of time, but they're never great at it. You know,
right.
There's never going to be somebody who's so perfect at it that they can just process all of that stuff that you just listed perfectly. And so it becomes sort of a more imperfect game in a way that, you know, that we're comfortable with. And, you know, there's more mistakes in the face-to-face game.
Even when you're, I see where you're going now. You can, there's a lot more errors.
Yeah. And a lot more people guessing wrong about what it is that they're supposed to do, or guessing right about the fact that Nathan is a treacherous thus and so I should deal with that, but not actually having time to figure out the best scheme for how to get him. Like, you won't always have time to write the best orders. You won't always have time to talk to all the other people around the board about the implications of what it is that you're about to do, that sort of thing. Anyway.
And that's one of the biggest differences. In face-to-face, you've got a whole aspect of the game called time management, which you don't have on email, because you've got all the time in the world on email.
Yeah.
So I appreciate all the observations, and I completely agree. Is there any easy advice for someone that's trying to make that what sounds like a difficult transition from online to face-to-face, just from your perspective?
Well, my best advice is that the first several games that you play face-to-face, don't worry about your performance. You know, you're going to get your ass kicked.
Right.
So just realize that's going to happen, and pay attention to learning the differences between face-to-face and email. Start paying attention to how people communicate to you and what their tells are. Everybody's got tells. You know, this is really common in poker. People know when you sit down at the table, you're looking for the person's tells.
Yep.
Well, you do the same thing in diplomacy because, you know, 90% of the time people are lying to you. So you got to figure out who's lying, why they're lying, how you can work around those lies, you know, and it just takes time to get used to sorting through all that information. And if you're really, really worried about your performance on the board, you're not going to be paying attention to the important part of the game, which is the interpersonal interactions.
Jerry like knows stuff about this game. I almost forgot he plays so seldom anymore.
I didn't forget because he always beats me.
Yeah, that's true.
I was just gonna say there's a reason why I'm always 1 point ahead of Nathan.
Right, always.
You're like the Obi-Wan Kenobi of
Columbus. Yeah, he's something like, where it's like
you've grown more powerful than we could.
But everybody's got a player out there that's sort of their arch nemesis in that way, not in like an evil way, but sort of like, you know, the guy that always gets you.
Yeah.
For me, that's Jerry. Jerry's always like, oh yeah, uh huh, yep. Go ahead, Nathan. Try that out. Yep. Yep. Uh-huh. And he just apparently knows my tells really well.
They're not that hard to say.
Right.
No, they're
anybody
not.
Anybody wants to know Nathan's tells, email me.
Yes. Yeah. Thanks, Jerry. That's really helpful. That's really, really helpful. So, you know, just for those that don't know, because it is true, as Eric mentioned, that Jerry isn't out and about on the tournament scene right now, and I don't think you're playing a lot online, but back in 2001, Jerry did win the Grand Prix, which is...
Yeah.
Which, what? Oh, you're just sad because you've never won one.
Yeah.
Oh, well, let's bring it all back to Eric.
Did I come in second that year? Yeah, I probably came in second that year. No, I didn't.
Yeah, well...
I wasn't even playing.
No, you weren't even playing.
I was too young to play back then.
But, so, can you talk a little bit about that particular experience and how that worked?
Winning the Grand Prix?
Yeah.
Well, it worked by me shelling out way more money than I had to go to a bunch of tournaments. The first step of winning the Grand Prix is showing up.
Yeah.
But probably, I mean, my best memory of 2001 and winning the Grand Prix was pulling off one of the more infamous stabs in diplomacy history on Spencer Bernard simply by showing up at Tempest.
Oh, yeah. I had forgotten about that.
Right. Spencer and I were neck and neck for the Grand Prix, and Spencer thought he had in the bag because he was going to Tempest on the East Coast, and at the time, it didn't look like I was going to be able to afford to make the trip. But there was no way I was going to lose the Grand Prix just by not showing up. So I got the money together, I came out there, but it was kept secret from Spencer until the night before the tournament that I was going to be there. And the look on his face was priceless, but it may have driven him out of the hobby.
Yeah, it might have.
Since then.
Yeah, I don't think he played after that.
No, I don't think he did.
Six of one, half dozen the other, you know.
But it is sort of, I think, you know, you just showed up and said, hey, buddy. And
And the blood drained from his face and everything. And then, of course, Andy Marshall, who was the tournament master for Tempest, he thought it would be fun to, in the first round, put Spencer and me on the same board with Spencer in England and me in France. So what fun that was.
Yeah, good old Andy Marshall.
Well, yeah, that just goes to show you the power of a tournament director. And,
For those of you listening at home, tournament directors don't usually do stuff like that, but Andy Marshall used to do stuff like that.
Yeah.
He just liked to, like, make boards. I think, what did he call it? Is his Andy Marshall maximum fun?
Yeah, he maximizes fun.
Yeah.
Yeah, there was no randomness involved in those country assignments at all. That was
most tournaments. Most tournaments there are, but that one, not so much.
Yeah, he just had a reputation for doing it. That was pretty great. So, yeah, that's actually... I'd forgotten completely about that story, Jerry. Thank you for sharing it. For those listening, there's all sorts of levels of ways to play this game, and I think we're going to talk in a future episode specifically about just tournament play. And one of the things that we'll say at that point is, you know, the tournament starts as soon as you arrive. And it's,
the tournament never ends.
Yeah.
The tournament is always ongoing.
Yeah. It's always... It's not all just what's on the board sometimes.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, we all know that we should not bring our relationships off the board to our play on the board. We also all know that it's not possible to do that.
Yeah.
And you do bring your relationships from off the board onto the board. So it's best to pay attention to your relationships, even if there's not a board between you.
Yeah. And where would you draw the line about that if you did draw that line? I mean, if you and a friend are out for drinks and you buy the drink and then you're later playing diplomacy. Everybody's always playing just because diplomacy people a lot of times are just sort of like outgoing people anyway that like to be social and do nice things for other people. And it's not because they really just want Belgium. But yeah, they're kind of that way.
Well, I think it's inherent in the game. The interesting thing about diplomacy is it's not really a war game. I mean, if it was a war game, it would really suck. You know, it's like stupid blocks and fleets. It's not a good war game. So the board is really just the context within which people are interacting. The game itself is all about interpersonal relationships and reading each other. And that's called life.
Yep.
So the game is just a way of putting life into the context of a specific experience so that you can try out things that you might not even try out in life, like totally intentionally screwing somebody you like. You know, and hopefully you don't do that in life too often. But on the board, it's like, yeah, I really like this guy. I'm gonna fuck him.
I love the turn of phrase intensely screw. I think that's a new one for me.
I got a lot of them.
Yeah, no, we will, and hopefully not have to bleep out too much of that.
Yeah, well,
right.
We had to recover ourselves for a second there. And I know that we have to keep this interview fairly short, so we want to ask the question that we always ask, and Eric usually beats me to ask.
What is the greatest, biggest mistake that you've ever made on a diplomacy board that just you wish you could have back in a game?
The biggest mistake I made on the diplomacy board is sort of an in-depth mistake. It was in 2001 in Denver, the North American Championships. It was my first championship. I was doing really well. And it actually, when I figured out the points later, if I hadn't made this mistake, I might actually have won the tournament. But what happened was David Hood was there, and he had given this talk in between rounds about how he plays diplomacy and the things he likes and the things he doesn't like. And he had made this huge speech about how he hated the RT. He didn't like playing the Russia-Turkey alliance at all. So the next round comes up. I'm assigned to a board with David Hood. I'm in Turkey. He's in Russia.
Wow.
So I go to him and I say, you know, you just told everybody in this room how much you hate the RT. So that's probably not what they're going to be looking for from you. So want to roll? You
know? Yeah.
And he said, yeah, okay, sure. So we started doing the RT and we were doing fairly well. But what happened was that within the first couple of years, I don't remember which season it was, but fairly early on, I misordered. And I ordered like something like Constantinople to Greece or something like that, you know, just a really stupid misorder. And it slowed us down. It set us back. Not enough to stop us, but enough that I was like really embarrassed about it. Because I was so embarrassed about making a stupid mistake while playing with the great David Hood, because this is my first tournament.
Right.
David Hood reputation. Ever since that I made that mistake, the whole rest of the game, I was sort of deferring to him and trying to make up for it.
Yeah.
And because of that, I didn't argue for parity. I let him grow much larger than me and all these things. And I ended up, you know, he ended up taking the game and taking me out.
Oh, okay.
And so the mistake I made was letting that mistake affect my play with my ally later on in the game. You know, I should have just like said, okay, I made a stupid error, but now I'm getting back on my game and paying attention to my game rather than worrying about what he was thinking of me or my play or something like that. And when I figured it out, if I had just gotten into a draw in that game, I think I would have taken the North American Championship that year. So it cost me big to learn the lesson of every move is a new game.
Yeah,
maybe you made a stupid mistake in the spring, but it's fall now, and you need to start arguing for your position from where you're at now and not be making up for past mistakes in the game.
Yeah, if you're going to be deferential or just sort of ashamed of what you do, it should probably be some sort of a gambit. Like, you feel like you need to act that way so that someone keeps working with you or something.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Well, Jerry, I gotta say, I was in for an interview that was a little bit short on the shorter side for us. You've managed to pack in some great advice, and we need to have you on the show more often because you make us look smart.
Oh, that's really hard to do.
Yeah, it's not easy.
I know.
Okay, yeah, anytime. Anytime you want to chat about this some more, I love talking about diplomacy, and hopefully I'll get back out on the tournament circuit soon.
Well, hopefully we'll see you in January. Pretty much confirming it this weekend, last weekend of January, will be WAC.
Okay, I'll try and keep my schedule open then. Last weekend,
and I will send you an email and everyone an email about confirming that. I just need to make a phone call, and the announcement should go out on Monday.
Yeah.
Sounds good.
All right. Thanks, Jerry.
Okay, thanks, guys. Bye.
You have been listening to Diplomacy Cast. Thanks, everyone, for joining us.
Wasn't it fun?
It was great.
I had a great time.
Yeah, definitely. For Nathan Barnes, I'm Eric Mead. Signing off. We'll talk to you next time.
For Eric Mead, I am a giant 13-foot-tall chocolate banana.
I was just trying to sound like a radio guy. That's what I get. Bye, everyone.